Mr. Henry Van Emden, Reel 3. We're talking about some of the things you did before you went to France in 1944 with 704 Company, Royal Army Service Corps. What about, had you ever learned to drive? I mean, I know you were in charge of the petrol thing, but did you learn to drive?
I learned to drive in the army.
Now, when was that?
When I first, a short while after I joined the company. When I joined 704 Company, the first thing they did was to take me out in a lorry and taught me how to drive.
Now tell me about that. What was that like?
I went out with a corporal in a 3-ton lorry, and we're going along the road, and things are going fine, I'm doing all right. And it was a narrow road, and coming along from a distance, we could see another lorry coming towards us with a big notice on the top, TNT. It wasn't a delivery van like it is now. TNT meant dynamite. And the corporal went green. So I said, don't worry, I'll hold the wheel steady and I'm not going to panic. It'll be all right. And the other driver came along. He saw our oil plates on it as well. He must have gone a bit green. And we passed about that much between us.
8 inches to 10 inches.
Yeah, about 8 to 10 inches. About 10 inches. And that was it. And after that, I gradually went on. And I finished the driving lessons, and an officer tested me and then gave me a licence, so I was now entitled to drive.
Now, what about just before D-Day? What are the preparations? Anything? You had this waterproofing. Now, you'd gone off on a course, a mine course, but anything else before you go?
When I was... we was at Sevenoaks, and... two things. It was end of May, about 24th, 25th May, and we saw a plane coming over on fire. They caught a plane on fire there. And instead of coming down, it went straight on, as straight as a die, and we were puzzled. And a bit later, another one. What's this plane's on fire? And then the following morning, it came out that they were doodlebugs. And when they ran out of fuel, they landed wherever they landed, full of explosives, and caused havoc and disaster wherever they landed. And that was the first time they came over. Jumping the gun a little bit, I took great pleasure in overrunning some of the ramps where they should have sent them from when we were in France, so I couldn't send them anymore.
We'll come into that. Anything else about this last couple of weeks before D-Day?
It was my birthday on the 25th, and my parents had to get special permission from a very high-ranking officer to come down and see us. And we took over a pub for the evening and took the company in the pub to buy everyone drinks. And a bit of a party. And they knew we were going very shortly, and that was it. And of course, after the party, they were sent home again. I got to the train. I took them to a train and got them home again, and that was it. That was about the only specialist thing apart from that I can think of.
So tell me about the lead up to D-Day then. What, the last couple of days, what happened?
The last couple of days, we were marched to Tilbury. We marched into a camp in Tilbury, near the docks, very close to the docks. And once we got into that camp, it was sealed off. Once it was sealed off, Montgomery came round and said a few words to all ambassadors to England. You don't go around raping women or that sort of thing. Don't pinch anything. You're supposed to be ambassadors of England, and you've got a good name of the country to think about. And I wish you all luck, and that was it.
What did you think of Montgomery?
I met him several times. Digressing for a minute, the first time I met him, it was 1941, and I was a musician, and that particular night, it was a Monday night, I was playing at the Savoy, and I'd got two cases in my hand. One was so big, a saxophone, one was a small one, which was a clarinet. As I walked in the door, four men were coming down the stairs, And when they saw me, they stopped in their tracks. I could have had a machine gun and a handgun in those cases, because the war of them, they didn't know me. And the doorman stepped forward at that minute, and he said, "Oh, good evening, sir, how are you this evening?" I said, "Fine, thank you, Johnny, all right." He said, "Yes, lovely, thank you." But that was like advance and be recognised, and the four men carried on walking down the stairs. The first one was a lieutenant general, that was Montgomery. It's the first time I met him. Followed by his boss, Lord Allenbrooke, chief of the Imperial General Staff. Followed by his boss, Horbelisha, who was the Minister of War in those days, now the Minister of Defence. Followed by his boss, Winston Churchill, the Prime Minister. And anyway, by that time, of course, I got down the stairs, so I said, "Good evening, gentlemen. Have a safe journey home." I said, "Thank you very much. I said, I'm just going to play now." I said, "Enjoy yourself. Good night." They went off, and I went to play. That's how I met four of the top men in the country. What else? Yeah, on this transit camp, everybody from the private pioneer man, if you like, to the general in charge of the whole place, was sealed off. Nobody could make a phone call or receive any communication at all. That was it. It was dead secret. And then the following day, I think, we were all marched to the docks, and I got on board a magnificent American liner. It was trailing a few landing craft as well with it. And we got on there, we got ordinary peacetime meals from the Americans. They hadn't got rationing.
You don't know the ship's name?
No. I have no idea.
So what happened next then?
So we enjoyed our luxurious food, if you like. And then we went along the coast to Southampton. And when we got to Southampton, we had to wait there while a whole load of ships joined in the convoy, because they wasn't just going across the channel with one ship. We all got together, and we went across, and it took a week. The D-Day started.
So what day did you start off? You started after the D-Day.
I don't know the date I started off. A few days after D-Day, maybe. A few days, I think. Because when we got on that ship, it took a week to cross the channel.
Now, why did it take so long?
Because we had to wait at Southampton for the other ships to join the convoy. That took a couple of days. And eventually, when we did move up, we got to about a mile offshore. And all hell was breaking loose because the ships were firing, big guns were firing shells into the rear of a landing ground to try and knock out the German tanks and the German guns, which were firing back at us and also firing on the beach. So we're transferred to one of the landing crafts, and at that stage I'd got a brain gun as well. I had a number two who had carried all the stuff, the spares, barrels and all the ammunition. And I had the spring gun. And then I had to climb down a rope ladder to get into this lorry. So I did that. A strange thought, of course, was my mind. I'm going down this ladder. I thought, my mum wouldn't see me now. She'd go mad. I got into the car, into the lorry. A few more people got in, and then we, only a mile offshore, it should take a few minutes to land. And the wind changed, and the sea got rough, and instead of going like this, it was going like this. I was the only one that wasn't seasick, I'm hanging on like grim death. And finally, after about 8 hours, I think, a great big wave came along, and whoosh, bang, down come the lad, down come the flap, and I drove off, and the beach master was yelling, "Get off the beach, get off the beach." I didn't need telling twice, because there's, as I say, a lot of noise going on with guns and machine guns. I shot across the beach, and there was a ramp on the right-hand side. And up that ramp, and you go straight through into a road, which leads you out of Arromanches into the fields. And once we got into the fields and we got a bit inside, it was a much easier then, because we got away out of the firing line. And we all gathered in this field. And we were there for some time, because As I cleared the field in front of us, the infantry, as the field got cleared, the bridgehead got wider, we were able to move forward. And before the company moved from field A to field B, I took about half a dozen men, and we used to go in front of the company before and dig up for mines and booby traps.
Tell me about that. Did you ever find anything?
Yeah. A telemine is so big, like a very big soup plate would be. A plate of yellow meal on. It's very round and about this thick.
About
3 inches thick. And there was a knob in the centre. Now, if a man trod on that knob, nothing would happen. But if a lorry went over that knob, which was the whole idea, it would get blown up. And sometimes they strung, a dozen telemines in a whole area, connected together by wire. So if one went off, the lot went off.
So how would you deal with them?
You feel round them for a start off. If you find you've got, you're like a big meat skewer, that's all. You didn't have these walkie-talkie things they got now. A big meat skewer. And you prodded in front of you all the time, so it was okay. And you hit something. You try it again, and it was a stone. You'd be very careful. But if it wasn't a stone, and you hit something, you thought, what's this? And then you feel around gradually, and you feel to say, oh, is it a telemine? And then you go around very carefully to see if it was connected to another wire or anything. It wasn't. It's on its own. Right, so we marked it. Now, once you've done that, you get it out of the ground, and you've got to unscrew the top and take the fuse out. Once the fuse is out, that's the dodgy bit, taking the fuse out. It's like, how can I try to describe it? It's like taking something out of a sheath. And if you catch the size, it goes up and that's your lot. So you have to be very careful. And then once you've done that, you can chuck it away. And it just went off with a little spark or something. And then the mine was safe. And you had to do that all the time.
And were there many telemines?
Quite a number. Quite a number.
And were there any of the shoe or S mines?
That's the only ones I saw.
Telemines. You didn't meet the ones with the three prongs?
And those. I met a lot of those as well.
Now how would you clear them?
Once again, you could take the top off under the fuse. You took the fuse out. I mean, it was all right. It was dodgy, but you had to, what you had to do. You had to unscrew the top and take the fuse out.
Did you find any booby traps while you were moving forward for the, for the unit?
Only those.
Just mines, not sort of booby traps.
I didn't find, like I explained, where you've got a nice looking pen in a drawer and you open the drawer and there it is, and you picked it up and you got killed.
You didn't find that?
I didn't find any of those, no. And that was all there was to that. And the last night, we used to be in a place for 2 or 3 days at the most. And all of a sudden, because there were some snipers about as well, we had to try and deal with. But they dealt with the snipers.
Who dealt with the snipers? The infantry.
The infantry, and, or at least the tanks. So our lot was all tanks. So tank commanders, so we'd try and fire at where we thought the bullets was coming from. But mostly the guardsmen did that.
Now, this is before the breakout, is it?
Oh, yes. And before the breakout. And
were you doing your other job, your job of running the petrol dump as well, or not?
Well, it was static because they couldn't go forward past Caen. And I had the stuff already loaded. As soon as word comes through they wanted, I could give. But meanwhile, I was doing these other things. I was doing, as I say, going out and sleeping with the mines. So one occasion, we was in one place for weeks outside Caen, because we still couldn't get through. We were there for weeks, and then finally an order came through, right, we're moving to the next location tomorrow morning, so take your team and go and clear that field. So I got to the lorry, and I'm just getting on board, and another man puffs up. So a man come puffing up to me and said, "I'm sorry, I've got to take your place." I said, "I'm just going off." He said, "No, you're not, the colonel wants you." "Well, if the colonel wants you in the army, you go." So I said, "Well, all right, carry on." So I went back to the colonel. I said, "Yes, sir, what can I do for you?" He said, "Well, you know, the people in this village have been very nice to us for a change. They've looked after us," I said, "with food and so on." I said, "Yes." So he said, "So we thought we would give them a little send-off when we leave, we leave tomorrow morning. So tonight we're going to invite the chief of police, the mayor and dignitaries, and give them an evening in our mess with some food and drink." I said, "Oh, yes." He said, "We've managed to get hold of a piano, and we've even managed to get it tuned. Would you mind very much playing for us?" "Well, if a colonel asks you to play for him and you want a piece for a life, then no one else can do it. You've got to do it on your own." So I said, "Yes, okay." And I'm playing. And we had a very good night. And some stupid idiot went out in the field and they missed their mine and some of them got killed. I'm sitting there playing the piano and some of them got killed in that team, in the mines team. They got killed and that was it. So we went forward a bit. And we were on about a mile outside Calm by this time, overlooking on a hill, overlooking Calm, could see right into it. And then after we'd been there a few nights, by this time it's about the 4th or 5th of July, I think. I wouldn't remember the exact date, somewhere around about that, early July. And we heard a drone in the sky, so we all took cover. And when it was a plane, and when we got closer, we could realise it was airplanes. It was all right. Followed by another two planes very closely each side of him. He flew into Caen, and when he got to the centre, he dropped a flare. The other two separated to each end of Caen, and they dropped flares. So now there's three flares going. And a few seconds later, we heard a much bigger drone in the sky, and three planes came along. When they got on top of Caen, they picked out their different targets, and they dropped bombs. You could see the bombs leaving the plane. You could see the damage they were doing when they were landing. And followed by another three planes. And this went on for hours. And it was only the following day they announced it was a 1,000-bomber raid. It's the first 1,000-bomber raid I'd ever experienced. I never want to experience another one. And there was a 1,000-bomber raid. And, of course, after a little while, Calm was blotted out completely. And it was smashed to pieces. And the following day, when our tanks went in, and of course I followed them, and when we got into Caen, there was one big cathedral. It had been smashed, but a lot of the French people had taken shelter in the downstairs part, the crypt, and they were coming out, and as they're coming out, they were staggering around because they were dazed. They didn't know where they were, but they were safe. This lad got killed. And we went through this complete shambles of Caen, and then of course we got to the other side, and we were going along the main road going towards Falaise, where the breakout was. And it was the most amazing sight. There was loads and loads of horses and cattle were killed, and some, I don't know how they did it, but some people had piled them up about 5 high or 6 high, one on top of each other, and the next one, it went on for about 2 or 3 miles. And you couldn't believe it. The smell was diabolical, but you couldn't believe it. But there was all these horses and cattle neatly piled up, all dead, obviously, until finally after about 2 or 3 miles, that stopped. And then we got to Falaise, it was all burning. And I felt sorry for some of the French people there, who were ordinary people, who could afford to buy food and that sort of thing, scrounging around the back of restaurants because there was no food until supplies were coming in, and they had to sort of scrounge around and try and keep themselves together while the place was burning. I was glad to get out of Calais, of Falaise.
How did you get on with the French civilians generally?
Pretty good, not bad. I first come across Brie cheese, and that sort of thing, it was lovely. And as long as you paid for it and you didn't interfere with them in that sense or try and do anything wrong, They were very nice. They were fine. They were very upset in general because people whose fields had been bombed had lost everything, and the farms had gone, or the mines had, the fields had been mined and booby-trapped, and nobody came along to clear them for them. So they had to leave for the time being until it was safe for somebody to come along and clear it. We only cleared our own particular patch. By we, I'm talking about the whole of the army, if you like, just cleared their own patch each time. They didn't bother about any other fields or any other farms. They just sorted their own. And that's why a lot of fields were still, we had bad mines. I wouldn't mind betting there's still mines and booby traps somewhere knocking about over there.
Now, how about your actual job when you started moving forward? How did it work in the field?
It worked very simply. I was about a mile behind the front, behind the tanks, in my sector. And an order would come through to the major, petrol and oil, please. So I would take seven lorries, filled up with petrol and oil, and
now deliver. Where would you take it? Where would you get it from?
But I'd already got it. I'd got it. In the first instance, I got supply from the base dump. A supply from the base gave me my initial lot. And then it was loaded onto seven lorries, and we went to the front. I got hold of the tank commander. Here's all your stuff. It's so much here. Thank you. Sign. Thank you.
Would that be done at night when they were lagered up?
No, mostly during the day. Mostly during the day. And
so what would happen then?
I would go back to the base, because I got my chit to get another lot, back to the base, get a fresh supply, and then move forward to the location we were in and put it in a safe place as possible. And that was it. It was guarded sentries and so on, but and that was it until we kept, every time we went forward, repeated the performance. But one of the most difficult parts, when we got to Holland.
What about Belgium? Anything first about Belgium? Or
We went to Holland first.
Oh, okay, right.
We went to Eindhoven.
And what happened there?
When I got to Eindhoven, you've seen that film, A Bridge Too Far, I think. They kept on dropping parachutes over there's five rivers. I can't remember them all, but there's five rivers. The Scheldt, can't remember.
Doesn't matter.
There were five bridges, and these parachutes used to go in over four. Most of the Americans went over the four bridges, and they were able to land on the opposite side of the bridge and hold it before the Germans could do anything about it. And that's why we got a corridor, a narrow corridor. We got as far as Nijmegen, which is at the other side of the other end of Holland, and that became dodgy because they couldn't come back and they couldn't go forward. They were stuck at Nijmegen and the Germans were shelling them, and what we had to do was to take these lorries and go through a place like Hagenbosch and places like that, Vorst, and so on. And we finally got to Nijmegen Bridge. And we waited, because they were shelling sometimes. And as soon as they stopped shelling, we went across the bridge and got to where the tanks were, delivered the goods, and then we come back again. On one occasion, we come back. And when I got back to Eindhoven, another two lorries followed in the lorry I was in. There's three lorries in. I said, well, where's the other four? Nothing. Nothing. So we waited. And we couldn't find out what happened. And nothing happened at all until about 3 days. And all of a sudden, the other four came in. The Germans had been cutting the road because the road was raised. And there was only one road. The Germans cut the road. And fortunately, the drivers could see well in advance. They saw what happened, and they just did a three-point turn very quick and went back to Nijmegen. And when word came through that the road had now been cleared again. Then they went back to our depots. They came back to me, so I was all right again. And eventually we, that was Holland.
Anything else happened there?
Yeah. One day when I was in Nijmegen, they word come through, there's a concert going on at the main building. Would you like to go along? Oh yeah, be a break from before we go back. Okay. So we all went along, and there was a piano in the centre of the stage, and a little man came on to start playing. It was Solomon. Solomon was just about the greatest pianist in the whole world on classical music.
What was his first name?
I don't know.
Just call him Solomon.
Solomon. I've got a recording here. I can have a look. But Solomon. If I can find the first name, I'll have a look. But Solomon. And it was fantastic. And we were enjoying it. And all of a sudden, a couple of shells came over. He was just finishing a piece. So he finished and stopped playing. He said, ladies and gentlemen, if you are worried about these shelling and you want to take cover somewhere else, I'm quite happy to pack up. If, however, you want to carry on sitting there, I'm quite content to carry on playing. Hooray! So we all clapped and he carried on playing. You know, like Ashkenazi is today, he's just about the greatest, Vladimir Ashkenazi. And this chap was the same equivalent. It was fantastic. And then we went back, but then it all went very wrong. We were in Nijmegen, and the tanks were all lined up, and I was there with my petrol and oil, and we looked across, and we could see parachutes coming down. That was when they were trying to take Arnhem. And the idea being, they were going to hold the place for 24 hours, while our tanks went straight through the main roads, only 11 kilometres to Eindhoven, to where the bridge, Arnhem. Only 11 kilometres to Arnhem, a straight road. So the first tank went along, got about 50 yards along the road, and a place called Diehl, D-E-A-L, I think, was an 88mm gun. Have you ever seen an 88mm gun? And it was deadly accurate. And as this tank went along, bang, up came a shell, and it bowled it over. Now, there's only one road, and to shift a 50-ton tank is not funny. So they were stuck. They finally moved it, another tank came up, and the same thing happened, so they couldn't go. So they hadn't got the means to eliminate this gun, and which was several miles away, and we got stuck there. Meanwhile, of course, those poor devils who was in that cauldron, as it was called, were stuck there for over a week, for about 10 days, I think. And they were getting hopelessly hammered by the Germans, because they got two tank divisions, which had been lumped into one. They got a crack division there, and we hadn't got any tanks or anything like that to arm. All we got was brain guns and machine and rifles. That's about all they got, and a couple of jeeps. And the commander of that tank, General Urquhart, went to have a look with his jeep and another brigadier, Lansbury, and a private, I think, driving the wagon. And as they're going along this road, they see some Germans coming, a big tank. So they quick dodged off the road and hit the vehicle,